two dates, indicating each individual's term of service in the Earth Defense Alliance. This was followed by, "Made the ultimate sacrifice to protect us all." "All these people served up here?" I asked my father. He nodded. "And they died up here, too," he said. "Those are officers who lost their lives in the line of duty." "But they were just drone pilots, right?" I said. "How did they all die?" "During previous attacks the enemy has made on this base," he said. Then, before I could ask him to elaborate, he said, "I'll explain in the briefing." When we reached the end of that corridor, my father led me onto a turbo elevator that carried us down to the operations level, located over a mile beneath the lunar surface in just a few seconds. Then my father led me through a series of cavernous chambers carved into the lunar bedrock, which housed the cold fusion generators, life support systems, matter compilers, and the enormous gravity distortion array. "I don't know how most of this stuff works," my father confessed, "or even how to operate most of it. But I've never needed to because all of the base systems are completely automated, and all of the maintenance is done by drones operated by real people back on Earth." When we passed the glass-walled med bay, I saw that it, too, was staffed entirely by drones. The base doctor appeared to be a specially equipped aethid with a pair of articulated human hands that allowed a surgeon back on Earth to operate them remotely. "A doctor in London used one of those med drones to remove my appendix a few years ago," he said. "The procedure went flawlessly." The crew quarters were packed onto the same level, 50 modular dorm rooms, each designed for two residents. "Since only three of the rooms are currently occupied, everyone gets their own private digs," my father said. He pointed to a door labeled A7. "These are your quarters. The door has already been coded to your biometrics, and your pack should already be inside." I held up my QCOM and checked the countdown timer. "Why even bother giving me a room?" I asked. "The Vanguard arrives in just a few hours." "It's not like I'm going to try to take a nap between now and then." "No," he said, smiling. "But you might want some privacy later on, once you're able to call your mother." I stared at him until he met my eyes. "Are you planning to call her?" He shook his head. "I doubt that would be a good idea," he said. "Why would she be interested in speaking to me once she finds out I'm alive and that I abandoned you both?" "Of course she'll want to talk to you," I told him. "She'll be overjoyed to find out you're alive." Then, without thinking, I added, "just like I am." He studied my face. "You really think so?" "I know so," I said, although I was trying to convince myself as much as him. "She never got over losing you. She never fell in love again after you. She told me so." My father suddenly turned away, and I heard a small noise escape him, like the sound of a wounded animal caught in a trap. When he made no other attempt to reply, I motioned to the other doors lining the corridor. "Which room is yours?" I asked. He pointed to the first door at the end of the hall, labeled A1. "But that's not part of the tour," he said, attempting to steer me in the opposite direction. "Just let me peek inside for 1 second," I said, standing my ground. "Please? Sir?" "There really isn't that much to see," he said, still interposing himself between me and the door. But judging by his reaction, there was clearly a lot to see, and I was determined to see it. I didn't move. Our standoff continued for a dozen or so seconds before the general finally stepped aside and palmed open the door, his face already flashing red in embarrassment as I squeezed past him to peer inside the tiny modular room. The entire back wall of my father's quarters was covered with photos of me and my mom, including all of my yearbook photos going back to grade school. A photo of my mother in her nurse's uniform, which he must have found on her hospital's website, was hanging over his bed. The rest of his walls were completely bare. Before I could examine his living space further, he prodded me back out of it into the hall, then locked the door. "Hurry," he said, trying to hide the unsteadiness in his voice. "Every second counts." 16. Another turbo elevator hurtled us downward at an unsettling speed, then slowed to a stop just a few seconds later. A screen embedded in the wall displayed a 3D map of the base, and it indicated that we'd just arrived at its lowest level, at the very bottom of the egg-shaped structure nestled into the Daedalus crater. When the doors hissed open, we stepped out into a short, blue-carpeted corridor that terminated in a pair of sliding armored doors with Drone Operations Center neatly stenciled across them. Above these doors, spray-painted on the wall in stylized graffiti, was the name Thunderdome. The doors slid open as we approached, and I followed my father through them into a large circular room with a domed concrete ceiling that was painted a bright iridescent blue, like the screens that were used on movie sets as placeholders for digital effects that would be added later. "Welcome," my father said, stretching out his arms, "to the Moonbase Alpha Drone Operations Center. We call it the Thunderdome." "Why?" "Well, because it has a dome," he said, pointing up. "And we fight inside it, just like Mad Max." He shrugged. "And because Thunderdome sounds cooler than Drone Operations Center." In the center of the room, on a raised platform, was a rotating command chair with curved ergonomic touchscreens built into its armrests. It was encircled by 10 oval-shaped pits sunken into the stone floor, each containing an individual drone controller pod. Unlike the multifunction stations we'd used back at Crystal Palace, these pods appeared to have been designed to control interceptors exclusively. Each pit contained a simulated ADI-88 interceptor cockpit, a pilot seat, flight stick, and all of its familiar control panels and system indicators arrayed beneath a wraparound display canopy that slid into place over you when you climbed into the pilot seat. My father tapped a button on his QCOM, and the bright blue dome over our heads switched on, like the screen of a high-definition television, providing a 360-degree view of the cratered landscape surrounding the moon base that made it seem as if we were standing in the observation deck on the base's top level instead of in a reinforced bunker far beneath the lunar surface. As he led me across the enormous domed bunker, I glanced inside each of the drone controller pods at my feet. I could see through their semi-transparent canopies, and four of the pods were already in use. Debbie, Milo, Wodey, and Chen were inside, giving their new rigs a test spin in some sort of training simulation. The Japanese EDA officer I'd spotted earlier was standing at the command console with another EDA officer, a tall, dark-skinned man I'd never seen before. Both men looked about the same age as my father, and both had the same weary, battle-hardened demeanor I'd seen in him. As they walked over to greet us, I glanced down at the collars of their uniforms and saw they both held the rank of major. "Zach, I'd like you to meet two of my oldest friends," my father said. "Major Shin Hashimoto and Major Graham Fogg." "Konnichiwa, Lightman-san," Major Shin said. I saluted him, but he threw me off by returning it with a bow. "It's good to finally meet you. Your father has told me way too much about you over the years." He grinned. "I've gotten pretty sick of it, actually." "Sorry," I said, just to have something to say. Shin studied my face until it started to feel creepy. Then he glanced over at my father, then back at me, comparing our faces. "Holy Toledo," he said, whistling. "You really are the spitting image of your old man." He elbowed me in the ribs, grinning broadly. "My sympathies, kid." He laughed heartily at his own joke, and my father gave me an apologetic look, the same look I used to give to my mom when one of my friends came over and broke something. But I laughed politely in return, then turned to shake hands with Major Fogg, who appeared to be the tallest person on the moon. "It is my distinct pleasure to meet you, Lieutenant Lightman," he said brightly. He surprised me by speaking with a thick British accent. "Welcome to Moonbase Alpha." I glanced at the shoulder of his uniform and saw the Union Jack there instead of a U.S. flag. I also noticed that the word defense on his EDA insignia was spelled with a C instead of an S. "It's just the three of you?" I asked. "No one else is up here?" "Just us," Shin said. "A resupply shuttle comes up twice a month, but the rest of the time, we're all alone. Not counting all of the drones, of course. Graham nodded. The Alliance used to have dozens of people stationed up here to help keep all of the different systems running smoothly, he said. But once the QCOM network came online, almost everything could be done remotely with drones, so they cut back to just a skeleton crew made up of essential military personnel. There used to be a few more pilots stationed up here, my father added, including Admiral Vance. But now it's just us. The Three Musketeers, Graham said, smiling. Lucky buggers that we are. A long folding wooden table and three folding metal chairs were arranged against the far wall. The table's surface was covered with a variety of Dungeons and Dragons rulebooks, gaming screens, and dozens of oddly shaped dice. We play D&D 4 or 5 nights a week, Graham explained when he saw me eyeing the setup. Helps to pass the time. Shin is usually our dungeon master. He smiled at me. My character is 27th level Elven Archer. Why don't you show him your character sheet, Graham? Shin said. That will really impress the kid. Graham ignored him and continued to shadow me with an enthusiastic smile as I wandered around the control center, like a kid showing off his room. A short distance away, I spotted a large drum kit, 2 electric guitars, and 3 mic stands, flanked on either side by a stack of amplifiers. I wandered over to examine the gear. What, do you guys have a band or something? I asked. Indeed we do, Graham said proudly. We call ourselves the Bishop of Battle. It's the name of the short film starring Emilio Estevez, I finished for him, from the Nightmares Horror Anthology. My father and both his friends blinked at me in surprise as goofy grins spread across each of their faces. I grinned back, then nodded at my father. I saw it when I was working my way through all of your old VHS tapes. I cut myself off when I realized how revealing my last statement had been. But none of them noticed. They were all still beaming at me for getting their band name. I like this kid, Xavier, Shin said. My father nodded. Yeah, so do I. We can play some pretty decent Van Halen covers, Graham continued. Maybe we'll jam for you guys later. Sure, I said uncertainly. That would be cool. I glanced back over at my father, but he was staring at his feet and shaking his head in embarrassment. We're not going to play for them, Graham, I told you, he muttered. Aliens are invading in a few hours, remember? What better reason to rock out one last time? Graham replied, throwing up 2 sets of devil horns. I stepped over to the edge of the nearest drone controller station pit and peeked in. There was an out-of-order sign scotch-taped to its tactical display. What happened to this one? I asked. Graham spilled Coke Zero on it, that's what, Shin said. Cost the war effort millions. Stop trying to pin that on me, Graham grumbled back. You left your sandals lying around and I tripped over them. Those millions are on you, Shinbone. Graham laughed, but when I laughed too, he scowled at me. What's so bloody funny, kid? He said. I fried 1 drone pod. That's nothing compared to the zillions of dollars in drones we lost this morning, thanks to your little stunt. Shin nodded, and they both continued to scowl at me for a few more seconds before they both burst into laughter. Ha ha ha, I'm joking, lad, Graham said, still laughing. I must have watched the video clip of you chasing that glaive into the base 50 times so far today. Priceless, that was. Shin shook his head. How did you stop Viper from murdering you for that? Maybe he realized I'm already a dead man, so there was no point. My father frowned at me and seemed about to say something, but Shin changed the subject before he could. Care for some snackage, Lieutenant? He asked. Your favorite snacks were listed on each of your EDA profiles, so we stocked up on all of them. You're a Lucky Charms man, right? Dry, with no milk? We laid in a few dozen boxes for you, see? He pointed over at one of the unoccupied pods across the room, where 6 boxes of my favorite breakfast cereal sat stacked up like crates of ammunition. The other new recruits had an assortment of snacks and beverages laid out on the floor around their sunken pods, too. Stacks of nacho cheese combos and Slim Jims were scattered around Milo's pod, along with a small mountain of Diet Mountain Dew. There were bags of cheddar jalapeno Cheetos and a row of 2-liter bottles of Hawaiian Punch laid out for Wody, bags of multicolored Skittles for Debbie, and beside Chen's pod, dozens of silver energy drink cans with QILI printed on the side, surrounded by writing in Chinese. How did our favorite snacks end up in our EDA profiles? I asked Shin. But it was Graham who answered. The EDA knows everything about everyone, kid, he said. Your food and beverage preferences weren't the only things being recorded while you were playing Armada and Terra Firma. Trust me. Your pulse rate, blood pressure, sweat content. The EDA makes the CIA and the NSA look like the PTA. Great, I said. The government has been spying on all of us our whole lives, but at least we get to have our favorite snacks. Bonus. To my surprise, my father grinned at my remark. Just then, the other new arrivals emerged from their pods, and he went over to greet them. Chen snapped to attention when he saw my father approach, and the others scrambled to follow suit. At ease, recruits, my father said as he walked over to them. Welcome to Moonbase Alpha. I'm General Xavier Lightman, your new CO. I apologize for keeping you waiting. He scanned their faces, waiting for a response, but my new friends all seemed too starstruck to speak. My father walked over to stand in front of Milo, who was grinning like he was about to meet one of his favorite movie stars, his earlier disdain apparently forgotten. You're Milo Dobson, right? Better known as Cushmaster 5000? Milo nodded imperceptibly, caught in the throes of some sort of gamer fanboy aneurysm. It's an honor to finally meet you in person, Lieutenant Dobson, my father told him. He turned to the others. It's an honor to meet all of you. Wody, Crazy G, Atomic Mom. He shook hands with each of them in turn, then nodded at me. And, of course, Iron Beagle. You're five of the most gifted pilots I've ever seen in action. We're privileged to have you here. The others smiled, and their faces flushed with pride, and mine may have a bit as well. Thank you, sir, Chen said, carefully repeating his QCOM's translation. Yeah, thanks, General, Milo said, finally recovering from his stroke of paralysis. I mean, holy shit, that's a huge compliment coming from Red Jive himself. You're the best of the best of the best, sir. I've been studying your moves for years. We all have. My father seemed genuinely embarrassed by this praise. You're giving me way too much credit, he said. Then he pointed to his two comrades. Shin and Graham were both heavily involved with your simulator training, too. I'm sure you'll recognize their call signs. Shin uses the handle Max Genius, and Graham... My call sign is with Nailed, Graham finished, though these two rarely use it. We prefer to call him Limes instead, Shin said. It's short for Limey. He hates it. Graham nodded. Indeed I do. We all smiled in recognition at their familiar call signs. Max Genius and With Nailed were both mainstays in the top 5 pilot rankings, too. Since the first year the game was launched, they had both alternated between 2nd and 3rd place, right below Red Jive. I don't mean to be rude, General Lightman, Debbie said, but when are you going to tell us why the EDA sent us up here? She glanced over at Shin and Graham. Why couldn't we just remain back on Earth with the other recruits? My father exchanged a strange smile with his two friends, then nodded at Debbie. I was just about to brief all of you on that subject, he said. Graham smiled. Then he motioned to a row of low, padded leather bench seats behind us. You guys might want to be sitting down when you hear this, he said, before sitting down himself. Milo and Debbie joined him, but Chen, Wody, and I remained on our feet. My father waved his hand at the view screen covering the domed ceiling, and the image arrayed across it changed. We were no longer looking at a live feed of the lunar landscape outside the base, but at an animated, 3-dimensional graphic of our solar system, with the spinning planet Earth in the foreground and the moon lazily orbiting it at a distance, both surrounded by a series of concentric rings indicating the orbital paths of the other planets. My father made another gesture at the screen, and the animation of our solar system began to speed up, making the planets zoom around the sun like a pack of race cars, each on a separate track. One of the things you weren't told during your enlistment briefing is that this isn't the first time the Europans have sent ships to Earth to attack us, the general said. Over the past 4 decades, they've done it exactly 37 times. On the domed screen, the celestial clockwork of our solar system continued to spin forward until the orbits of Earth and Jupiter aligned, bringing the two planets into their closest annual proximity. Then, as the orbit of Jupiter's moon, Europa, brought it as close as possible to Earth, the animation froze. Every 398.9 days, a celestial event known as the Jovian opposition occurs, the general explained. When the Sun and Jupiter are both on opposite sides of Earth, and Europa is at its closest proximity to us. Ever since our first contact with them, the Europans have used that proximity to send a small detachment of ships to Earth to conduct surveillance, test our defenses, and abduct live human specimens for study. He tapped his QCOM display, and an image of Moonbase Alpha appeared on the screen, seen from above, nestled into the Daedalus crater. Once the Europans began to send scouting missions to Earth, the EDA decided to construct a secret defense base here on the far side of the moon, the general said. It was originally intended to function as a long-range surveillance and communications outpost, but when it finally became operational in September of 1988 and a permanent human presence was established here, the enemy's tactics changed. When the next Jovian opposition arrived, the Europans didn't send their detachment of scout ships directly to Earth. This time, they came here to Moonbase Alpha first and attacked it. Video footage began to play on the domed view screen, showing a large formation of Glaive fighters streaking down from the starry blackness of the lunar sky to descend on the tiny moon base nestled in the crater below, as interceptors began to launch out of the base's hangar and fly up to meet them, setting off a massive aerial battle. "We managed to fight them off, but just barely," he said. "It took nearly a full year to repair the damage. And when the next Jovian opposition arrived, the Europans attacked again, this time with an even larger force, to match the increased size of Moonbase Alpha's defenses. And, once again, our forces were barely a match for them." "The same thing happened again the next year," Graham said, "and the year after that." "Each year they sent even more drones to assault the base," Shin said, "and every year we increased our defenses here in anticipation of their next attack." My father nodded. "This escalation continued for over a decade, until the Europans changed the game on us again last year by unveiling a new weapon, one you've all encountered before during your Armada training, the Disruptor." A collective groan escaped the new recruits. On the view screen, we watched as a cluster of enemy ships appeared, descending toward Moonbase Alpha in perfect formation, creating an image that momentarily resembled a screenshot of the game's Space Invaders. A wireframe diagram of a spinning dodecahedron appeared adjacent to it on the view screen, and I felt the hair on the back of my neck stand up. "The Disruptor appears to function by coupling itself to a large celestial body, like a planet or moon." On the view screen, an animation showed a spinning chrome dodecahedron making landfall on Earth and then firing a beam of red energy into the planet's core. "The device then harnesses the planet's magnetic field, using it to generate a spherical field that disrupts all quantum communications inside it." "All of the EDA's drones have backup radio control units," Shin added. "Unfortunately, the Disruptor interferes with normal radio communications too, so they're useless." On the view screen, the emerald green Disruptor began to generate a transparent sphere of red energy that enveloped the entire planet Earth, along with its entire atmosphere, causing the EDA's drones to fall out of the sky. But the moon was outside of the Disruptor's range, as was the secret EDA defense base on its far side. "The quantum disruption effect only works if the transmitting and receiving ends of a link are both contained inside its spherical field," the general said. "If either the drone or its operator are located outside of the disruption field, the quantum link is completely unaffected and remains intact. If the enemy manages to couple their disruptor to the Earth, only the EDA personnel stationed up here on the moon, that's us, will still be able to control the drones we have stockpiled back on Earth, and vice versa. My father flipped away from the wireframe animation and back to the footage of the enemy fighters, revealing a large, onyx-colored dodecahedron, a dark, multifaceted jewel spinning in their midst. The object pulsed rapidly in color, from jet black to molten red along its illuminated, angular seams. Just before the Europans attacked this base during the last opposition, they activated the disruptor, coupling it to the moon's magnetic field, which is relatively weak compared to that of Earth. As he spoke, the pulsing dodecahedron fired a red beam of energy into the moon's core. It began to generate a spherical field of energy around itself, which increased rapidly in diameter until it completely covered Moonbase Alpha, along with large patches of the moon's surface, which I knew from our briefing was in a pattern that matched the moon's inherent magnetic field. When the disruptor switched on, it knocked out our ability to control drones from here inside the base, my father explained. But all of the EDA drone pilots located back on Earth were unaffected because they were outside the disruption field. Shin pulled a different graphic up on the screen, showing Earth and its nearby moon, the far side of which was covered by the disruptor's transparent field, which was enormous, but not large enough to envelop both the moon and Earth at the same time. The enemy's drones continued to function for the same reason, my father said. Their operators were back on Europa, hundreds of thousands of miles outside the disruption field. Shin nodded. This base has a backup hardline intranet, he said. So we were still able to defend the base using the surface guns and with tethered backup drones, which were all hardwired and thus unaffected by the disruptor. On the screen, footage showed sentry guns all over the exterior of the base, powering on and returning fire as the enemy Glaive and Wyvern fighters kept right on attacking, raining down a steady barrage of laser fire and plasma bolts on the base defenses. Down on the surface, a few dozen tethered Aethids and Warmechs also continued to defend the base, unspooling their fiber optic tether cables behind them, which drastically limited their mobility, effectiveness, and range. The EDA sent several squadrons of reinforcement interceptors up here from Earth, he explained, and with their help, we were eventually able to destroy the disruptor, but the base was badly damaged, and we barely survived the attack. Is a real disruptor as difficult to destroy as the ones in the game? Chen asked via his QCOM. Shin, Graham, and my father all nodded. Then how did you guys manage to take it down? I asked. Shin and Graham both grinned, as if they'd been waiting for this question. It takes two to make a thing go right, Shin recited, smiling cryptically. Graham nodded, then added, It takes two to make it out of sight. They looked as if they were about to recite more of the song's lyrics, but my father shook his head slightly and they both fell silent, waiting for him to continue. Some people think we got lucky, my father said, glancing at Shin. Personally, I think the Europans allowed us to destroy it. Why would they do that? Debbie asked. Good question, my father said. Here, watch the footage and decide for yourself. He tapped his QCOM again, and another grainy video clip began to play on the view screen. This footage was shot from one of Moonbase Alpha's surface surveillance cameras, Shin said, approximately 23 minutes into their attack. All quantum and radio communication is still being jammed by the disruptor. Most of the base, and nearly all of its surface defenses, have been destroyed by this point. On the view screen, the smoking ruins of the moon base were visible in the background, its orb-shaped exterior crawling with spider-like alien drones skittering across its armored metal skin and burrowing into it with lasers. In the foreground, just beyond the lip of the Daedalus crater, was the mammoth disruptor dodecahedron, spinning fiercely just above the lunar surface as it blasted its pulsing red coupler beam down into the moon's magnetic core. In the velvet-black lunar sky above, hundreds of interceptors were launching an assault on the disruptor's shield, firing on it from as many different angles. As you'll recall from your training, the disruptor has only one weakness, Shin said. A steady barrage of laser fire and plasma bolts will bring down its shields, but the disruptor's power core is so large that it recovers far more rapidly than any of the enemy's other drones. Its shields only drop for about 3 seconds, then come right back up at full strength. And 3 seconds isn't long enough to destroy it, Milo said. At least, it never was in the game. That's why no one has ever taken down a disruptor, not even the Flying Circus. Look, Shin pointed at the screen. Here he comes to save the day. On the screen, a lone EDA mech appeared, power leaping across the lunar surface, fearlessly charging toward the pillar of blinding red light created by the disruptor's transparent coupler beam. Old Viper Vance! Graham shook his head in admiration. Watch him go!
Admiral Vance is controlling that mech?
Wodey asked. Yes, my father said. But he was still just a general back then. He used to be in command of Moonbase Alpha. I took over his post when he got promoted to admiral, in part for the act of bravery we're watching now. Although Viper used to do crazy shit like this all the time, Shin added. That guy was fearless. I'm sure he still is, my father said quietly, his eyes still on the screen. We continued to watch the silent footage of General Vance's charge toward the disruptor, wondering what would happen when he closed the remaining distance to it. How was he controlling that mech with the disruptor still in operation? I wondered aloud, still studying the footage intently. He's moving too fast to have a tether, isn't he? My father nodded. You're right, he is, he said. Tethered drones were always too slow and too vulnerable for Vance's liking. He nodded at the screen. He's piloting that mech from inside it. There's a cockpit embedded in its torso just above its power core, which Viper is setting to overload right about now. On the screen, Vance's mech came within arm's reach of the coupler beam, and then suddenly went limp and fell to the surface like a giant metal rag doll, throwing up a cloud of dust. He set his mech to self-destruct from inside it? Milo said disbelievingly. Did the old man have a death wish? Shin and Graham nodded. Then Shin motioned to my father. I used to think he and General Lightman here both did. I pointed up at the screen. But he isn't going to have time to eject. My father nodded. Vance's escape pod launch system was damaged during his charge. So now he's trapped there, next to his own time bomb. I had already started counting down the 7 seconds it would take for his power core overload sequence to complete, but I'd only hit 5 when 2 more mechs appeared, running up from the bottom of the video frame. Laser and plasma fire rained down on them from the dogfight still raging in the dark sky above the burning, half-destroyed moon base. Then I heard a familiar classic rock song blasting over Vance's comm. A song from my father's Raid the Arcade mix, Black Betty by Ram Jam. That's one of our nicknames for a disruptor now, Shin said, nodding at the spinning black dodecahedron on the screen. A Black Betty, or a ten-sider. I continued to study the view screen. As the 2 Titan war mechs bounded toward the motionless one containing Vance, they moved in a strange sort of unison. Almost like a pair of synchronized swimmers. They both seemed to dodge and zigzag perfectly again and again, just in time to avoid being obliterated, always in forward motion, seemingly oblivious to the geysers of rock and moon dust erupting all around and sometimes directly ahead of them. Shin paused the video. Your father is operating both of those mechs, simultaneously. He's inside the one on the left, and it's connected to the mech on the right, via a short fiber-optic tether inside a titanium-reinforced cable stretching between them. Shin would know, my father said, never taking his eyes off the screen. He finished helping me rig them together about 10 minutes before this footage was shot. Shin pressed play again, and my eyes were drawn back to the screen. I watched as 2 mechs lumber forward, unloading their sun guns and laser cannons into the disruptor's massive spherical shield as they passed underneath its mammoth spinning form and the coupler array at its southern pole. Then, the mech my father was in reached Vance's mech, ripped its escape pod free with Vance inside, and tucked it under his arm like a football. A ring of explosive bolts fired around the armored cable, tethering my father's mech to the one beside it, severing their connection. My father's drone threw Vance's now limp drone skyward like a shot put toward the disruptor's still-shielded coupler array. In the same motion, he power-leaped in the opposite direction, while hurling Vance's escape pod in front of him, a bare second before ejecting his own. Both of their pods flew out of the frame just before Vance's mech finally completed its 7-second self-destruct countdown and detonated. 2 seconds later, the drone my father had hurled skyward did the exact same thing. A perfectly timed 1-2 punch. A nearly impossible shot, like a 3-pointer from full court with 1 second on the clock. But even that amazing bit of timing wasn't enough, because just before both mechs would have impacted against the disruptor's transparent shield, the shield dropped, leaving the dodecahedron unprotected for that narrow 3-second window while its massive power core recharged enough to power its defenses back up. It was during this incredibly short sliver of time that both mechs detonated, one after the next. The first detonation struck the disruptor's diamond-hard hull, but its armor appeared to absorb the blast somehow, and the triangular facets of the dodecahedron's skin lit up molten orange as the energy dissipated across them. Only when the second mech detonated a half-second later did the disruptor's weakened armor finally fail in an explosion that took out the disruptor itself. Graham and Shin both broke into applause. I got the feeling they had watched this footage on a regular basis and that they applauded like this every time. Wody, Milo, Debbie, and Chen all applauded too, but I abstained. I was too busy staring at the screen. "Can we watch that footage again?" I asked. "At half speed this time?" Shin nodded and ran it again. Then he ended up running it for us several more times at everyone's request. The footage became more impressive and more unsettling to watch with each viewing. My father had truly pulled off a one-in-a-million shot. If the disruptor's shields had failed a split second earlier or later, his attack would have failed too. And studying the time counter on the video clip, it looked as if the disruptor's shield stayed down a fraction of a second longer than it should have, just long enough for my father to pull off a miracle. "How many more disruptors are on their way here right now?" Milo asked fearfully. "You left that little detail out of your briefing." 3, my father said. "There's one disruptor accompanying each wave of their invasion force." 3? Milo repeated. "There's no way we'll be able to destroy 3 disruptors one after the other. Not with a massive alien shitstorm coming down on us." My father nodded. "Yes, I'd say that's a real long shot. But we do have one last card up our sleeves. The icebreaker." "But I thought the icebreaker mission already failed," Debbie said. "It was destroyed before the melt laser even breached the surface of Sobrakai. Europa, I mean." "The icebreaker you escorted last night was destroyed, yes," my father said. "But we had a contingency plan. We hoped we might be able to destroy the Europans before they launched their armada, but we knew our chance of success was extremely slim. So we constructed a second icebreaker, which was hidden inside a hollowed-out asteroid and placed into orbit around Jupiter to avoid detection by the Europans. As soon as their armada departed for Earth, leaving Europa unprotected, we launched the icebreaker. It's already on its way."
"When will it get there?"
"It should reach Europa about the same time the second wave of the enemy's armada reaches Earth."
"What if we don't survive the first wave?" Debbie asked.
"Then the icebreaker won't make any difference," Shin said. "But that's why we have to make sure we do survive, because then we may finally get our chance to end this war once and for all." I waited for Graham or my father to agree with Shin, but both of them were silent.
"Anyone hungry?" my father asked. He held up his QCOM.
"I just got word the drones have finished preparing our dinner in the mess hall."
"Thank God," Milo shouted, already moving toward the exit. "I was afraid that Cheetos and root beer would be my last meal. Let's eat."
Wody and Debbie nodded in agreement, as did Chen once he heard the translation. "I don't have much of an appetite," I said.
If I was about to die, I wanted the breakfast my mother made for me that morning to be my last meal, not some Salisbury steak dinner reheated in a Moonbase microwave. My father nodded, and he and Shin began to lead the others toward the exit. Graham saw me straggling behind and threw an arm around me. "Trust me, you'll change your mind once you see the spread up there," Graham said. "They sent up a special 5-course gourmet meal for us on your shuttle."
"Why?" Debbie asked. "Because it will probably be our last meal?"
"Probably," Graham replied, giving me a grim smile as he quickened his pace toward the exit. "That's why I, for one, intend to stuff my face."
17. The Moonbase Alpha dining hall was a long, rectangular room containing 4 circular tables made of brushed steel, flanked by matching benches bolted to the floor. Several modular food and beverage dispensers were embedded in one long wall, along with a few microwaves, but no replicator, as far as I could tell. The opposite wall was dominated by a large curved window that provided a stunning view of the massive Daedalus impact crater spread below us, like a monochromatic Grand Canyon. As promised, an extravagant meal was already laid out on the tables, ready and waiting for us. What looked like more than enough food for several Thanksgiving dinners. One of the steel tables was covered with a silk tablecloth and set with 8 place settings, complete with silver cutlery and fine bone china, and off to the side stood a row of 4 aethids standing at silent attention, ready to serve us. A paper tuxedo was taped to each of their chest plates. I took the last empty seat, between my father and Milo. Graham sat next to Debbie, and only then did I realize from their body language that the two of them were crushing on each other in a big way. Milo noticed it, too, and rolled his eyes, then nudged me and nodded at the two of them, then at Chen and Wodey, who were both making furtive eye contact, too. "This is just great," he grumbled under his breath. "Here I thought I was being recruited for an epic space adventure, but it turns out I'm a guest star on Love Boat, The Next Generation."
"Set course for romance," Shin quoted, doing such a perfect Patrick Stewart impersonation that Milo and I both laughed out loud.
Everyone began to pass dishes and serve themselves food. Everyone except Debbie, who bowed her head and began to mumble silently to herself in prayer. We all froze for an awkward beat, then bowed our heads in solidarity until she finished. Even with all of that delicious-looking food in front of me, I still didn't seem to have any appetite. But the day's bizarre events appeared to have left everyone else ravenous, and for a while they were all too busy stuffing their faces to talk. I cast a few sideways glances at my father, but he was shoveling food into his mouth robotically while avoiding eye contact with me. Chen was the one who broke the silence. "My phone is still not functioning," he said via his QCOM's translator. "When will I be allowed to call home and speak to my family?" My father checked the time on his own QCOM. "An hour before the Vanguard is expected to reach us," he said. "That's when the leaders of every nation around the world will break the news to their citizens. Once the cat is out of the bag, you'll be able to call home. We won't have long to talk, I'm afraid."
"Why is the EDA waiting until the last minute to tell everyone about the invasion?" Wodey asked. "That won't give the world much time to prepare for the Vanguard's attack."
"The world is already as prepared as it's ever going to be," my father said. Shin nodded. "The population is already beginning to panic. Judging by what's on the global news feeds, people all over the world saw those EDA shuttles with their own eyes this morning when they were flying around to pick up essential recruits. The media has been airing and analyzing footage all day, along with information about their connection to Chaos Terrain's video games. The whole world wants to know what's really going on." My father shook his head. "No, they don't," he said. "Once people find out about the invasion, chaos will spread like wildfire. Civilization will start to break down." Graham made a derisive sound. "The EDA knows people will be more likely to stand their ground and fight if they don't have time to turn tail and run for the hills." I looked at my father.
He briefly met my gaze, then glanced over at Debbie, who was staring down at the countdown clock on her QCOM. It was superimposed over a photo she'd set as her display background. Three smiling, dark-haired boys resting their chins on the edge of a swimming pool in the bright sunshine.
"Handsome boys," Graham said.
"Thank you," she replied. "I'm worried about them." Then she reached out and covered the countdown clock with her finger so she could still see her son's faces.
"What about you two?" Debbie asked, addressing Shin and Graham. "Is the EDA going to let you contact your families too?"
"I'm a bit nervous about that, actually," Graham said. "Me mum's still alive, but she thinks I died back in the 90s. My father had already passed by the time I was recruited, so I left her all alone, and she's been alone ever since. The EDA has taken care of her financially, of course, but emotionally, well, what can one do?"
Graham blinked a few times, then swallowed hard.
"I hope she still recognizes me," he said. "And if she does, I hope the sight of me doesn't give her a coronary. That is, if the PM's address doesn't do that first." He shook his head. "The poor old girl is in her 60s now."
I wasn't all that worried about how my own mother would react to the news our planet was being invaded. She had always been the picture of calm in the face of crisis. She seemed to thrive on it. But when she found out my father was still alive, well, that was another story.
"And you, Shin?" Debbie asked quietly. "Do you have any family, dear?"
Shin's smile faded slightly. "Unfortunately, my parents both passed away years ago, about halfway through my tour of duty up here. So I never got to say goodbye to them, which was extremely painful at the time." Then his expression brightened and he reached over and gave my father's shoulder a squeeze before slapping him on the back. "But my friend Xavier here had already gone through the same thing, and he helped me get through it. He lost his folks too, a few..." Shin cut himself off, then shot a nervous glance over at me and then my father, who was again staring intently at the tablecloth. "Anyway," Shin said, forging ahead, "right now I'm just thankful they got to live out their lives peacefully and that they're not around for what's about to happen." Everyone around the table nodded, save for my father, who seemed to be slowly turning to stone. Shin seemed to sense this, and he turned to me. "How you doing, Zach?" he said. "You holding up okay?" I nodded. Then I shook my head. Then I shrugged and shook my head again. "Don't look so worried," Shin said. "The general forgot to mention one thing during his little pep talk earlier." He gave me a conspiratorial smile. "We have a secret weapon. The greatest drone pilot who ever lived." He jerked a thumb at my father. "Did you know that your old man has shot down over 300 enemy ships? He currently holds the EDA record. Your father has also been awarded the Medal of Honor 3 times by 3 different presidents, Shin said. "Bet you didn't know that, did you?" He shook his head at my father. "He's too modest to even tell his own son."
"Seriously?" I asked him. 3 Medals of Honor?
My father nodded, closing his eyes to his embarrassment, the same way I did when I received compliments.
"They were classified Medals of Honor," my father said. "It's not like anyone will ever find out about them."
"I just did," I said. "Mom will, too, when I get a chance to tell her." He gave me a half smile, then dropped his eyes again. My mother would be proud of him, but that might not be enough, and he knew it. I could see it in the defeated look that flashed across his face whenever I mentioned her. My father knew as well as I did that all of his noble motivations and heroic sacrifices might not be enough to win her forgiveness, or even her understanding, for what he'd done to us, not in the limited amount of time she would have to do so. I still wasn't sure if I had forgiven him. I glanced over at my father. I knew he wasn't planning to call my mother, but I'd do it for him if I had to. I wasn't sure what he was supposed to say to her after disappearing for 17 years. I didn't know what I was going to say when we spoke, and I'd just seen her earlier that morning, or if she'd be willing to listen. But I had to try. When Wodey finished eating a moment later, she got up from the table and went over to the observation window, then spent a moment staring down at the radio dish nestled inside the enormous crater far below.
"What did you say that thing was again?"
she asked.
"That's the Daedalus Observatory," Shin said, with a tinge of pride in his voice. "It's the largest radio telescope ever built, by humans at least."
"We built it to talk to the aliens?"
Wodey asked.
Shin nodded. "This crater is near the center of the moon's far side, so this location is completely shielded from all of the radio interference created by humans, which makes it an ideal place to send and receive radio transmissions without them being monitored back on Earth," he sighed. "Unfortunately, the Europans have never been interested in talking."
"One of the first acts of the EDA," Graham said, "was to create an internal task force called the Armistice Council, made up of a bunch of prominent scientists, including Carl Sagan."
"I've been wondering about that," I said, interrupting him. "How did they get Carl Sagan to keep the Europans a secret for so long?"
"He knew the news would create a worldwide panic and upend our civilization," my father said. "He only agreed to remain silent on the condition that the EDA give him the funding necessary to educate the world's population and try to prepare them for the news that humanity is not alone. That was how he got funding for his Cosmos television series."
Shin nodded. "Unfortunately, Dr. Sagan passed away before things really began to escalate with the Europans."
"The Armistice Council kept on trying to establish peace talks after he died," Graham added, "but the squids never sent a single reply."
"Squids?" I repeated. "I thought we didn't know anything about the Europans' biology."
"That's the official story, all right," Graham said, adopting a conspiratorial tone. "But trust me, mate, they're squids. The brass knows a lot more about our enemy than they let on. They always have."
He glanced at Shin, then at my father, then back at me.
"What are you talking about?" Milo asked. "The Europeans declared war on us for no reason."
Everyone had given up on correcting Milo every time he referred to the Europeans as Europeans, even poor Graham, who actually was European.
"That's the official story, all right," Graham said.
"But does it make any sense? Think it through. If the Europeans had attacked us 10 or 20 or even 30 years ago, we never would have been able to stop them."
I sat bolt upright, then glanced at my father, but his eyes were locked on Graham.
"We couldn't even have stopped an asteroid or a meteor from wiping us out back then, much less an angry alien species with vastly superior weaponry and technology," Graham continued.
"They had the upper hand from the start, so why didn't they use it? Instead, they basically just handed us their technology, then gave us all the time in the world to reverse engineer it. Then they gave us even more time to build a huge stockpile of millions of drones to defend ourselves against the drones they were building."
It was more than a little disturbing to hear Graham vocalize many of the same questions that had been eating away at me ever since the EDA briefing.
"And they built all of their ships and drones in orbit above Europa in plain view of Galileo's cameras. There's no way they weren't aware that we were watching them. They wanted us to see. It was like they were running a non-stop, year-round episode of How It's Made by Aliens."
Graham noticed that Shin was now making a screw-loose gesture with his index finger and flipped him the bird as he kept on talking.
"The Europeans had this huge advantage over us, but then they slowly, gradually lessened it on purpose instead of just slaughtering us over a weekend. Why? Why send a small group of scout ships every year, year after year, to study us, mutilate our cattle, and attack our secret moon base?"
He lowered his voice to a whisper.
"But they weren't really even serious attacks. They never tried to destroy the entire base or kill everyone inside during their annual Jovian opposition assaults. Instead, they always do just enough damage to prove that they could destroy the whole base if they wanted to. Then they leave without actually doing it. Why?"
Shin interrupted him again. "Are you going to let him spout this nonsense in front of the new recruits?" he asked my father. "Right before the attack? He'll demoralize them."
My fellow recruits did indeed seem shaken by Graham's speech, as was I, but for a different reason. Everything he'd laid out matched my own suspicions with eerie accuracy. But I didn't want to hear it. Shin was right. Worrying about abstractions and unanswerable questions just hours before the fight of our lives was a pointless, even harmful distraction.
"You can't stop the signal, pal," Graham said.
"I've also heard from several reliable sources that one of their scout ships crashed in Florida in the late 80s, only it wasn't a drone. They recovered it with two dead European pilots floating inside a pressurized fishbowl cockpit. Word is, we've still got the bodies on ice in a bunker 5 miles beneath Wright-Patterson Air Force Base."
"He's just repeating old rumors," Shin said. "Alliance gossip. Bullshit stories that have been circulating through the ranks for decades. There's no evidence to support any of it."
"That's not true, and you know it, Shinbone," Graham said. "Why do you think the Sobrakai were designed to be aquatic extremophiles in the Chaos Terrain games? Because that's how the Europans really look, man."
He turned to address me and the other new arrivals.
"The Sobrakai Overlord's design was based on the biology of the real Europans. They just scaried him up for the public."
"Well, it worked," Debbie said. "I have nightmares about that Overlord whenever I forget to skip the intro and mistakenly catch a glimpse of him. It, I mean."
"Once again, I'm afraid the Graham Cracker over there is talking directly out of his ass," Shin told us. "We have no idea if they're cephalopods or not. That's just a best guess, based on their current habitat. In reality, we don't even know if they're carbon-based, or if they're even indigenous to Europa." He smiled at Debbie. "Don't worry," he said. "The Overlord is made up. He was invented by Chaos Terrain to give the enemy a face. A villainous, slightly humanoid alien that humanity could rally against. Like Ming the Merciless, or Darth Vader, or Zod, or..."
"I get the idea," Debbie said. She shook her head. "For some reason, not knowing what they look like at all is even more terrifying."
Wodey and Milo both nodded. I glanced at my father again, but he was studying my face, as if trying to gauge my reaction to what I was hearing.
"Do you believe any of this stuff, General?" Debbie asked him.
He hesitated a moment and exchanged looks with Graham before finally breaking his silence. "I'm far more skeptical about those rumors than Graham," he said. "However, I don't entirely agree with Shin's straightforward assessment of things either." He glanced at me. "We've all had our share of arguments about this, with Admiral Vance as well. We all interpret the limited data we have in a drastically different way." He smiled faintly. "Part of being human, I guess."
"You didn't answer the question, General," Wodey pointed out. "What do you believe?"
"Yes, General," Shin said. His tone was suddenly derisive. "Why don't you be honest and tell them the truth? Tell your son the truth about your theory. That should really give morale an added boost around here, just before 0 hour. Shin dropped his silverware onto his plate with a loud clatter, got up from the table and walked out of the mess hall. My father watched him go. Graham shrugged and continued eating.
"The three of us have been arguing this subject for years," he said. "Our differences in opinion were bound to come to a head today."
"Shin's just under an enormous amount of stress right now," my father said.
"We all are."
"What was he talking about?" I asked.
"About your theory?"
My father sighed and glanced at the others, who were all watching him intently, including Graham. Nearly everyone in the EDA at the command level agrees with Graham, in that the Europans' behavior and tactics over the past 42 years raise a lot of questions, at least from a human perspective. He shook his head. "The problem is that no one has ever been able to agree on how to interpret them. Most of the people in command, people like Admiral Vance, lost interest in trying to communicate with the Europans after they began sending drones here to attack us. Damn straight, I said, they declared war on us." "True," he said. "But what if the Europans waited until now to attack, because they have a hidden motive, one we still can't ascertain? Maybe we've misinterpreted their actions, or maybe they've misinterpreted ours."
"What the fuck is there to misinterpret?" I heard myself ask. "They're coming to kill us all, just like they've been promising to do since before any of us were born. The time for negotiating is past, don't you think?"
My father shrugged. He looked cornered. "I don't know, son," he said. "Maybe. I stood up. Maybe? Did you say maybe?
Calm down, Zach, my father said.